anthem, isn't it? What a guitar riff, Chris Clark, huh?
I'm enjoying it, especially through the headphones.
Oh, yeah, fantastic. Turning up loud. There's the volume knob right in front of you. I may never sing live again after throat surgery, said John Bon Jovi today. John Bon Jovi has revealed he may not perform live after he underwent quite serious throat surgery, saying he does not want to become a fat Elvis at the end of his career. His words, not mine. Anyway, he said he finds more joy these days in his philanthropic work with his JBJ Soul Foundation restaurant initiatives to try and help people living homeless in homelessness and poverty. John Bon Jovi compared the high from helping people less fortunate than him and washing dishes at his not-for-profit restaurants to the euphoria of walking out on stage to legions of adoring fans. Isn't it extraordinary? His high these days is not the arenas, is actually his philanthropic work helping homelessness.
Isn't that wonderful? It's a great story. I've read a little bit about John Bon Jovi, and because he's always been dismissed by the music critics, but actually by musicians, Springsteen, McCartney and others, they hold him in the highest regard. There's almost this disconnect between this uber-popular, absolutely gorgeous-looking man on stage, but actually a serious musician. But that part of the story never seems to have been acknowledged.
He sounds like a man with a heart, Ruth.
I can't talk. I'm just busy singing and listening to the tune.
Frank says, Wallace, should your guests lose their jobs, I shall show the same compassion they do to civil servants. Quite a response on that. Public sector cuts, good or bad. 6:37, the panel, RNZ National. It is time for I've Been Thinking. Ruth Money, take it away.
Well, I've been thinking that we need a victims litigation fund. And why I think that is that I have a number of victims and survivors that I support, and they're having to borrow money to pay legal fees when actually they are the victim. So case in point, I have a lady who had a child with a man. He is now in jail serving a very long sentence for sexually abusing their son. But he put a order on said son, which meant that means he can't go overseas. So she is now spending thousands of legal dollars to get this order, this court imposed order, lifted so that she can take him on holiday. And it breaks my heart that she is a victim of crime. It's just like victims of crime who have to pay to get protection orders. So I'm going to have a word to the Justice Minister once we know what the books look like, and I'm sure I'm.
This has been an ongoing issue, isn't it? After the abuse comes economic vandalism in a way, eh?
That's right. It's
very expensive
to be
justice.
A victim in Aotearoa.
Are you hopeful?
I am hopeful. We're saying the right things, so I'd like to see some details.
It's worth following up on that, actually. A victims litigation fund, and what do you have ideas in your head of what that might look like and that type of thing?
Yeah, I do. At the moment, the only people that manage funds for victims are victim support. It's actually a Ministry of Justice fund called the VAS Fund, Victim Assistance Scheme. But they all acknowledge that it's underfunded. For example, when there's a homicide, you get 30 counselling sessions and that's it. You should be solved after that. You should be cured, even though you've got annual parole hearings and all sorts of things that go on. So we really make it difficult to be a victim in Aotearoa. So I'm all about increasing, and that's why I ranted about the public service. I am about getting the money in the community.
You want results.
And at the level, yes, at the level and in the hands of the people that need it.
Makes sense. Kia ora, Ruth. All right, Ruth Money there. Chris Clark, I've been thinking.
So, Wallace, this afternoon I was at a funeral for a friend, and he died a comparatively young man in his late 60s. And the church was completely packed. There were photos on the screen, families there, friends spoke. And what it really touched me was the constancy of the picture that emerged of my friend. And in particular, what people didn't talk about. You see, he was remarkably successful in business. It hardly came up in the conversation. Instead, what came up through the stories of old friends, through his daughters and from the extended family, was this lovely, winsome picture of this big man who loved his children, loved his wife was about fun, stories of tears and scrapes and anecdotes and a whole lot of love, and a humble grandfather whose great joy was these two new grandchildren that he was getting to know. And it was just a lovely, lovely picture of a winsome life. And at the end, the minister quoted from a book written 3,000 years ago in which he summed up what he thought was the measure of a good person. And it was simply this, that you seek justice, you love mercy, and you walk humbly on this earth. Mm-hmm. And I thought that's a lovely description of a winsome life. And I'm hoping my eulogy is still quite a few years away. But I tell you what, if that's my eulogy, if at my funeral there's this wonderful array of people, these gorgeous photographs that are appearing of me doing stupid things with my kids, and ventures that didn't quite work out, what I've done professionally never gets a mention, then I think I'll feel pretty happy.
Say those again. What are those words again? The final words?
Three words were to seek justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly on this earth. A beautiful description, I think,
that's
of
lovely.
A winsome life.
They do those studies, don't they, of people who have got a terminal illness, and they talk about, you know, what was important in their life. And it's not how much you work. It's all of those good things, isn't it?
Very good. Ruth Money and Chris Clark this evening. Thank you both for that. It is 19 away from 7, the panel. Now, should a city sell off its family silver? Always a contentious topic, isn't it? And it's one increasingly being asked in these tough times. The campaign has been launched opposing the sale of the Wellington City Council's 34% share in Wellington Airport. A petition launched last week called Keep the Airport Ours. The last year, the Wellington City Council passed a majority vote to put the proposed sale of its shares out for consultation. The move followed Auckland Council's controversial move to sell 7% of its airport shares, sold for $833 million. Well, there's a public meeting about this tomorrow evening, I think, 6 o'clock, I think. A number of Wellington councillors across the spectrum are going, economists and so on. With us is the New Zealand CTU Wellington spokesperson, Sabina Rizos. Sure, Sabina, welcome.
Hi.
Just imagine you could sell down the airport shares and you could help pay for your 4-kilometre mega tunnel.
Well, that's not strictly what the proposal is. They're proposing to sell down the shares and set up a managed green investment fund.
Yes.
So it's not going to be money available to use on current Wellington infrastructure. It'll be a green fund.
Yeah, so this Mayor Tory Whānau had that idea of using proceeds to set up that fund instead of paying down debt, and would be protected against future councils withdrawing capital to pay down debt. What's wrong with that idea, Sabina? That doesn't sound too bad, does it?
Well, there's a couple of things. So, I mean, first of all, we're concerned about the sale of the airport. The airport itself provides a pretty good return as an investment. It's a public asset that we have a lot more control over than the CCOs in terms of the companies. Well, we can have a lot more control over it. Even though we're a minority shareholder, they can block major transactions. And from a workers' rights perspective, you know, as the spokesperson for Unions Wellington, we are concerned about, I guess, the implications for the working conditions of the airport, the fact that it is a pollutant, and that there is no mechanism to ensure a just transition. There wouldn't be public accountability for that if we needed to make changes to the way that it operated in terms of climate change. In terms of the investment fund, as I touched on, the airport provides a pretty good return. I think it's 11.4%. A investment fund, as we know, every decade or so, there's a huge financial crisis. And so there's likely to be a lot of variance in the investment fund. There's no guarantee that it's going to provide the same level of returns that the airport currently does. And there's a lot more risk. And what will end up happening eventually is that there will be a downwards turn in the economy and we will end up having to use ratepayers' money to prop up this investment.
Let's see what the panel think about this. Ruth, it's always quite a contentious issue for a city, isn't it, whether or not to sort of keep the shares or not, and be it your ports or your
I feel sorry
airport.
For Wellington. I'm sure people in Wellington are feeling like they're
put upon.
Yeah, they're getting put upon.
So, what would you do if you were leading this charge, Ruth? Would you just keep the shares in the airport or sell them down for? I think they're valued at $278 million.
I was interested in the fund model because you can still, other regional communities do it, or governance does
it.
Plymouth,
I think,
where
is
you, yes, where you can still get the return and still have some control over that asset so that you are still getting that return. I didn't have a huge issue with what I read about the proposal.
Well, I mean, the new Plymouth Fund, which you used as an example, is managed by, I believe, Mercer, which is it's not a green investment company. So it's providing probably a consistent return, but I don't know if it's necessarily investing in the same kinds of things that this proposal intends the fund to invest in. And also, the airport provides a consistently good return of 11.4%.
And doesn't sound too bad.
The estimates that the council officers that I've heard have put forward is putting it around 7% for an investment fund. So it's not.
Chris,
not really comparable.
Clark, are you happy with around 11%? Because there is that point that once you sell, you can't go back.
Yeah, Sabina, I'm listening really carefully to your argument. I'm a bit like Ruth. I'm not convinced. I'm very happy to be convinced. I'll tell you why I'm not convinced. I think the first question actually is around, is this truly a strategic asset? And that is a good argument for keeping it in public ownership. As it is, City Council only has 34%, so it's a minority interest in that strategic asset. It might have been a strategic asset 20, 30, 40 years ago, but there's plenty of examples now of airports that are privately run. I would have thought a strategic asset these days is something like a hospital, arguably a road, maybe even a tunnel, and pipes, where others won't actually do it except for through public funding.
Hang on, how do you get in and out of Wellington?
Well, there's plenty of ways in and out of Wellington.
There's the airport.
Well, the point would be just because it's run by the private sector doesn't mean that actually it will no longer work in and out of Wellington. And so I think it's that point, is that just because it's publicly owned doesn't guarantee that people can get in and out of Wellington. And if you wanted to guarantee that in public ownership, there's lots of ways of doing that. So electricity companies have been privatised, but they don't have carte blanche. So you have worker legislation, you have health and safety legislation, you have environmental protection, you have good regulatory planning and so on. And usually with assets like airports and certainly ports, you have disaster planning requirements. Yeah. So it's possible to put a framework around private ownership.
Final comment, Sabina?
Well, I guess what I would say in terms of it being a strategic asset is that it's a monopoly, and public assets, as Wolf touched on, are, you know, there's accountability attached to them. If we sell it, we lose control. And even though we are a minority shareholder at the moment, that still gives us a seat, I believe two seats on the board. And we can block major transactions, and we also get notified about what they're planning to do. We lose that if we're no longer involved. If there's a private company that's doing, the council has a duty to protect the well-being of the community that it serves under the local government.
Brief response, Chris.
Infratil doesn't have that.
I get your point, Sabina. It's a really good point. I would have thought the response to that is that it's about the regulatory environment or even the legislative environment you put around a strategic asset if you indeed sell it. And there's plenty of precedent for doing that in terms of selling electricity generating companies as an example of that.
Hey, needless to say, Sabina, lots to say on this, and you'll be toughing out these questions, I guess, tomorrow at 6 o'clock. Where is it?
Yes, we will be at Thistle Hall, 6 p.m. There will be an opportunity for the public to participate and have their voice heard by the councillors. So we really encourage people to come along.
Good on you.
And,
thank you, Sabina. Kia ora. That's Sabina Rees-Shaw there, the CTU Wellington spokesperson there on whether or not you should sell down the airport shares. Now, to this, some wonderful responses. Our question of the day today, people are sharing stories of what their in-laws have done on BuzzFeed. Do you have a story for us? Yes, you do. One's just come through. Emma says, Wallace, My in-laws visited from the UK to stay with us for 8 weeks several years ago. In week one, my mother-in-law rearranged the kitchen cupboards to make it easier to find things.
Oh, dear.
Quote, unquote. The rest of the stay was abundant with similar stories and interpersonal challenges.
I always say relatives are like fish, and after 3 days they go off. 8 weeks is a very long time.
Yeah, glad to say they are now ex-in-laws. Goodness gracious me. What are the ones? Dave, here's one here. Here's one that came to the panel. My father and mother-in-law, being of excitable natures and with too much Christmas cheer, ended a spontaneous row by throwing the whole dinner service we gave them for Christmas plate by plate, item by item, sort of at each other until there was nothing left to throw, says Rob. Gosh. Wallace, regarding my in-laws, my sister-in-law banned me from her wedding. My partner had to go, as was part of the band playing, as well as the family. It got worse. Lots to say on that. Extraordinary, isn't it, Chris? That it's when two families of different cultures and expectations come together
for the first time, because there's all these things that you assume are just normal, the way you eat, the way you sit at the table, the way you have a conversation, and then suddenly you discover, actually, no, it's not necessarily normal. And of course it happens in
and
the
then
eruption.
You throw it at someone
That's
else
exactly right, including the dinner set that was probably given to you by the other set of parents. I realised I'm pretty lucky though, Wallace. My in-laws were Dutch, and I think I got a pretty soft ride, because the thing about this is a generalisation, we'll now get lots of Dutch callers saying I'm being terribly unfair, but the one thing I've noticed with my Dutch in-laws was that they were very free with the advice, and they were remarkably frank with the advice, and that was part of the package. So they came to stay with us when we lived in Wales, and our child had just been born. And I had an agreement with my mother-in-law, which was very simple, that she was welcome to give as much as advice as she wanted on anything she wanted to give me advice on, including bathing and feeding and dressing a young baby. And I was totally free to ignore her advice. And we had this great arrangement. It worked very well.
Oh, okay.
Except I had the trump card. And my trump card was this, which I only think I exercised once, which was to point out to her that she was only 4 hours by car from Heathrow. And actually, as a consequence of that, we had 35 years of a great in-law relationship. Maybe I was lucky.
I'm incredibly lucky, but I have a friend, and I swear it is a friend. It's not my mother-in-law. But he has one of the worst mother-in-laws. She's really naughty with money, and she ends up bankrupt, literally bankrupt, not even just hard up, bankrupt. So she moves in, and then she'll sell their things to fund whatever she wants. She gets secret credit cards, and it is just no end of debacles, absolute debacles. I really feel for anyone who has a difficult relationship within their family.
Yeah, very, very good. Thank you for those coming. A couple of other ones that are saying, oh, my in-laws were blooming great. It was my wife that gave me grief. Says John and others, my in-laws actually weren't too bad at all. In fact, they're a big part of the family. So, yeah, your in-law stories keep coming. But that one there, passing judgment on my housekeeping by checking my garbage cans and testing for dust on top of the fridge, that's quite something.
It's next level.
It is next level. 2101, keep them coming. One more. My ex-mother-in-law tried to talk me into letting my sister-in-law breastfeed my newborn son. It was quite an awkward conversation.
Yes.
Yeah. Finally, on the program, Walt Disney theme parks updated their disability rules last week because, get this, they suspect able-bodied people were using their disability access service to skip queues. It's now the most requested service at Walt Disney Parks and has tripled over the past 5 years. It came as a surprise to me, but perhaps not so much for journalist Sally Wenley, who uses a wheelchair. Sally, sometime panellist, great to have you on. Kia ora.
Kia ora, Wallace.
Did your eyebrow raise when you saw that the service had tripled over the past 5 years?
Well, I've been fortunate enough to go to Disneyland in LA with my daughter and another girlfriend of mine, and the number of people that had wheelchairs that obviously didn't fit them and they would get to the front of the queue, the priority queue, and then they'd stand up and go on the rides and just go for it. And I got so grumpy, I got a bit sick of it, that once they shouted out, "Oh, it's a miracle, she can walk."
Good on you.
And that's great, Sally.
Black to that, and there were actually red faces. And I asked for feedback from people with spinal injuries about this through social media. And one of them said that, well, yes, he'd been to Disneyland too, and the plethora of empty wheelchairs left at the beginning of the rides was amazing. And then Disney had to take them away because they can rent them there and all sorts of things. However, in saying that, I do respect that there are many different disabilities and people who might be on the spectrum and they do need to go to the front for all sorts of reasons.
Yes.
And elderly people who can get there and maybe get off. But it is quite common. And I've also got other feedback from people with other events, somebody with a walking frame going to rugby, and then my mate said, he said, "Oh, but, you know, they leave their walking frame in the disabled area and they can sprint to the bar." And also on aeroplanes, someone said that, you know, multiple people use wheelchairs to get on the plane and then they just walk off. And then someone else said, "I love how they can heal during the flight and then they can run off the plane." And the sceptical people just, you know, this is just my group, I suppose, with spinal injuries, and someone said, "Anyone who requests a wheelchair for the plane door should have to use an aisle chair to board. One experience of that and they won't do it again because it's not that much fun." So
yeah.
I'm just coming from one obviously very visible disability area.
Right, yes. Mm. This is, Ruth, this is just extraordinary.
I
had no idea.
It never ceases to amaze me how people try
it on.
Yeah. I mean, they need to spend a day going up and down Queen Street in a wheelchair to realise how difficult it is to navigate people walking in front of you. And, oh, well, it wasn't the other day when I went down with my girlfriend. I just told her to run people over in the end. They were so rude and just were so unaware.
It was the people that were unaware.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes, and the roadworks. But it was the people that were completely unaware.
And also on that note, accessible rooms and motels, hotels, and I haven't had the experience, but I've been told about cruise ships because the rooms are a bit bigger and they're good if they're done correctly. And cruise ships, apparently the disabled rooms book out first and it's not disabled people that book them.
Oh, these people need
this is a whole story.
Wow.
Chris,
my gosh.
Sally, all our mouths are wide open when you're telling the story about all these people having these majestic healings when they came to Disney. It's wonderful. But tell me.
Yeah, I was hoping for that too.
Exactly. More prosaically, would you be offended, or do you think the disability community would be offended if they had a requirement for a letter or something that could be produced to show that actually the disability was genuine, particularly where the disability wasn't obvious to the naked eye? Would that be offensive for people from the disability community to carry something like that?
Well, somebody who is sort of able-bodied but has an invisible disability, maybe for them. But for me as a wheelchair user, no. And that's what Walt Disney theme parks are doing now. Yeah, mm. They have to provide justification of their disability. I hear your question. It is a bit humiliating, but I'd rather that happen than have all these frauds suddenly healing when they've got to where they want to.
I like that Disney said that they're actually going to give them a ban. So if they try and sneak in, then they're going to get a lifetime ban, which I think is appropriate.
Or is it too heavy handed?
No.
Actually, let's be frank, how many people get to go to Disneyland more than once?
That's true.
I totally support the lifetime ban.
You see through it, you've got a zoom lens in your thinking there. Great to have you on. Finally, Louise says, "My ex-mother-in-law called me by the name of the woman she wanted her son to be with for several years." Hilarious now, but not then. Hey, great show, team. Gosh, people, right? Ruth Money, Chris Clark. See you later. I'm Wallace Chapman with you today.
You're off to see your in-laws.
Yes, indeed.
3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.